I'd like to, I don't know whether I can finish what I'm suggesting today, but I'll take a stab at it, and that's the genealogies. And I might say, as you can see from the green sheet that you just have, not the number of genealogies. If people come in on your side, would you please get that? It might help a little. There are really, as you can see on the board, three columns of genealogies. The first one is so-called genealogy of Adam, and that has seven members, ending with Lamech. And then the second one, at the very last part of chapter 4, has three. By a misnomer, it's usually called the genealogy of Seth. He's the second one. They're really all genealogies of Adam. And then there's a third genealogy in chapter 5. That's really the one that most people know. Adam lived 130 years, and he begat Seth. And then he lived after he begat Seth 800 years, and then he had sons and daughters. He was a virile old man, and then all of his years were 930 years, and he died. And then it goes on, and every individual is part of this ongoing vital stream of mankind, and we kind of understand that one, maybe more or less. Except that what people have usually done is taken the numbers and tried to figure out the age of the world and all kinds of other things. What I would like to, we may speak of that at the end here. I'm not interested primarily in that, but I am very much interested in this one in chapter 4, which you have on your green sheet here. And I think the first thing I'd like to speak about is the structure here. It might appear at first sight as kind of disjointed. And in a sense it is. It's not as clear as the one in chapter 5. You might say that it's a genealogy to which some random annotations have been attached. Actually, it's quite well articulated if you know the language of genealogies. A genealogy can either be a vertical genealogy going through a line. That's the way it is pretty well in chapter 5. And the way it is here, too, in this one, the so-called genealogy of Adam, through seven members. And then when it gets to the end of it, all of a sudden, you'll have a horizontal genealogy. And then you'll have, in the case of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Or in this case of the first genealogy here, Jabal, Jubal, Tubal, Cain. And you will also have kind of a horizontal business where there are many nations and many side families besides the main line. Now, if you see here, the structure is not really, in chapter 4, the members of one family. That's really not what they're really interested in. But in mankind's cultural achievements. In the Soviet Union, I think in most of the Soviet blocs, I think that last night, Harold mentioned the fact that in Canton they had a park with the achievements of mankind. Well, that's what they do, and of the Soviet republics. I saw the one in Moscow, and it's a very interesting one. It's a permanent one. And here what you have is kind of, what shall we call it? An Old Testament version of Bernowski's The Ascent of Man. The achievements of mankind. And it's precisely that. It's mankind's achievements. And if you get that idea, that various members of various generations are presented as kind of discoverers of new skills, basic to civilization, especially when you get to the seventh generation there of Adam, that's Lamech's generation. Now, try to get this idea first, that in the last two sections that we've been studying here in our series in Genesis, we had the garden story, chapters 2 and 3, and we have the Cain and Abel story, chapter 4, 1 to 16. Those are genuine narratives. But the basic material in Genesis, in the framework, is the genealogy listing. And that was kind of the way in which information, especially technical information, scientific information, was given. Some of you might recall that in 1 Kings 4, where it talks about the wisdom of Solomon, what he did is not only composed the riddles and proverbs and so forth, but that he listed all of the plants, from the hyssop that grows out of the wall to the cedars of Lebanon. In the book of Job, when the Lord speaks from the whirlwind, he lists all of the various creatures that he has created, and all of the various powers that they have, and then he goes through it. That is a kind of encyclopedic material. And so here in genealogies, you not only have genealogies that would give the family, that's what we exclusively think of as genealogy, but also a kind of a listing scientific information, we'd call this. What is surprising here in the Israelite one, if you compare it to parallels in the ancient Near East, is that it isn't that these cultural achievements are gifts of the gods. We'll just give an example. In Sumer, plow, primitive plow, or even the hoe, is really a gift of the god of agriculture, which he gives to mankind. You know, from the Greek mythology, Prometheus steals fire from the gods and gives it to men. It's really something that belongs to the heavenly world. Whereas here, it's interesting that they take their monotheism seriously, and that they're to be fruitful and multiply and to have dominion over the earth. And so here we have in this listing some of the cultural achievements of mankind. Now, I'm just trying to give you an overview here first before we look at it in detail. We would, I think, all expect among the cultural achievements of mankind those skills that you have here. I put them in printed lines here next to it, that Cain is a tiller of the ground, agriculture, and that he divides, we mentioned that last time, with the keeper of sheep, Abel, his brother, division of labor, and that's one way in which brothers can help and supplement one another. They don't have to be killing each other the way it later happened in that story. But that started off as part of genealogy. That's why I put that in the part A here on your sheet here, the genealogy of Adam. It really starts in chapter 4, verse 1. Could add verse 2 there, too. Then in Enoch, the next member, you have city life. He built a city. And now you have settled life. It isn't just people following the herds and so forth, and in that way kind of getting close to domestication of animals. They actually have settled life. And the domestication of animals and following the herd and so forth is down here. That's interesting. It comes at the end of the genealogy. We don't hear any of the accomplishments of these people. If they knew of any, well, at least they're not mentioned here. And so you've got Jabal, who is the father of those who dwell in tents. Then you've got Jubal, the father of those that handle the pipe and the lute, the lyre rather, and music. They don't have any high technology, and that's kind of one part of the family. But the other part of it, you have an artificer in brass and iron, and that's Tubal-Cain. And, well, that's kind of the general thing that you could imagine, and I would expect that. But what you don't expect is kind of the shocker with which this chapter ends. That at that time, in primeval times, men, it's a human achievement, call on God, religion. Religion is not pictured here with the word revelation or something like that. Religion here is pictured as one of these achievements attached. And I think it's given the central place here at the very end, which is a rather surprising sort of thing, because we usually don't do it that way. Well, so much, I guess, for the structure. Oh, yes, one more thing about the structure. You'll notice that the Yavist, and I think this comes from the time of the early monarchy, has included in what I have here part C, that would be verses 23 and 24, potential dangers from cultural achievement. He's very well aware of that. Today, churchly people look at everything else as worldly, and they feel that the cultural achievements are merely a self-aggrandizement of the wicked people. And the church politicians, such as they are, get on jets and all the achievements of mankind, and perhaps look down upon all these achievements, or think that they're only there so they can get from one conference to another. Excuse me for being so rough with the church politicians, but I think if they do that, they just don't understand what in the world is happening in their very own lives themselves. And so I feel here that yes, there is in chapters 23 and verses 23 and 24 potential danger from cultural achievements. I wish they had, the writer had put it after verse 26 and showed the potential dangers that come from religion. Because that is one of God's good gifts that also can and is misused. Now, after that nasty remark, maybe we ought to listen to what the text says. And I don't know whether we should read it. Let me read the first two verses, because they're really not here in connection, because that Cain and Abel story, which you remember, that came in between, I said that was kind of a, at least its first part, was an expanded genealogical note. Well, Adam, that's the first one in the genealogy, knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, "I've gotten a man with the help of the Lord." Remember, I said that Cain really means creator, creature that she has created, and she's very exultant. And then I didn't put that verse down, I perhaps should have, in verse 2. And again, she bare his brother Abel, and Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And for the Israelite, it depended upon which time you're in, but largely, let's say, a farmer, represented, say, by Jacob, who gets the blessing from his father when he smells the Holy Land. This is great, whereas Esau has to kind of live way out there, and he's only a hunter, and well, that's far, far, far away. So I suppose that their idea of a tiller of the ground is some sort of a Cain is a first here. Well, let's leave that go, and let's go on to the next part of the genealogy. Can we just read the way we did ordinarily? Tim, would you mind reading there that whole part, 17 to 22? I don't know if you know all these big names, but don't worry about them anyway if you don't.
Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. He built a city, and called the name of the city after the name of the son, Enoch. To Enoch was born Irad, and to Irad was the father of the Jew, Elah. And the Jew, Jeloth, the father of Methushael, and Methushael, the father of Lamech. And Lamech took two wives. The name of one was Adah, and the name of the other was Zillah. Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have cattle. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the lyre and pipe. Zillah bore Tubal-Cain. He was a forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. The sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah.
All right. Does anyone have any comments, observations on what we have here before us?
Somewhat unusual to note a daughter's name in genealogy.
Yes, it's a kind of a little afterthought, Naamah, the beautiful one. Although I think what Herb Sorn said this morning, in these genealogies, even if the males are running the whole thing, they know there's not an entirely leaving out the female here. You see that? It's the whole family connected with that. Even the genealogy, which doesn't mention women at all in chapter 5, does in its introduction speak of God creating man, male and female, and it doesn't really want to leave it out. It's not nearly as male chauvinistic as it might sound to us today, you see that. But here you're right, that otherwise we don't hear anything of this Naamah. You do hear the two wives that Lamech has, and we'll hear them again in that sword song, Adah and Zillah. When people just, what shall we say, 6,000-yearized this whole thing and made it the history of salvation. I think you know what they did. They simply said that these people were always the bad guys, weren't they? They got more worldly all the time. And these people were the good guys. They started a religion. They kept the true name of God. And Jared means degeneration, and so here it starts going down. The sons of God are intermarried here with the, and then they would take chapter 6, verse 1 and 4, the stories of sons of God. I don't know why all the sons of God should be believers and the daughters of men should be unbelievers. And intermarried, and all the giants came out of them. And that's what people did with them. But I think that the only other mention of women here would be have Ada and Scylla, and they did that with them too. Ada means beautiful, and Scylla means tinkling. And so they said, Ada, this is merely sex appeal. These aren't genuine marriages. They weren't performed in a church by by an ordained clergyman. And so Ada is just a kind of a decorated woman, and Scylla, tinkling, has rings on her fingers and bells on her toes, and so she attracts them all with her sex appeal. And that's all they did with it. You see that? And Nauma means beautiful. And I heard a sermon at a wedding not long ago. You almost think that the only people who get married are Christians. I like Martin Luther, where he said, throw weddings out of the church and make them make their vows in front of the church. And then after a while, if you want to come and join the rest of the Christians in prayer and in the Eucharist, that's nice. But otherwise, it's just eine weltliche Sache, it's a worldly matter. So you don't have to have, Song of Solomon doesn't have the Word of God, the word of the deity in it at all, from one end to the other. Well, I'm a little feisty today, I don't know why, but I have several points that are bothering me. So don't get in my way. I'm sorry about that, I have to tell the students that. No, not really. I think that you have some interesting things here. Anyone want to make any other comments or questions? I think if you take this Bernowski's The Ascent of Man, the ancient version of it, if you take it in that way, I think you really see a lot more here than you would see otherwise. Well, let's just go a little farther there. Jabal, Jubal, and Tubal Cain are the big ones at the end here, I think. I suppose he's not just following the migrating herds, but actually domesticating them. I suppose if you want to put that in modern terms, what is it? He's got the King Ranch in Texas and the packing industry and controls the stocks and all kinds of other things, just to try to get that farther, you see that. But maybe that's doing too much. Jubal is music, and I think music in that case includes dancing, and includes poetry. Those were not split up as they've been today. I think it includes all those things. When you're wandering, I suppose you don't have chance, at least this side of the family, to have a lot of technology, so it's just pipe and lyre. But still quite some sophisticated. And then Tubal Cain, then you have this, chemistry, I suppose we'd say today, and the possibility of, bronze and iron, metallurgy. There too, all the rest of the surrounding lands would always have the divine artisan. The Baal myth has Cuthbertwochus, the great man that makes the divine artisan. The Greeks have Hephaestus and Vulcan, and you have all the stories about that. I traveled in South Africa once in Zululand, and I was amazed the myths that they told about the two bellows, one male and one female. And they told a whole myth about that whole thing, of how they finally could make malleable iron. And here this is very sober by comparison, extremely sober.
There seems to be two senses of parentage being expressed. On the one hand, there's the actual parentage, but then there seems to be a kind of symbolic parentage too.
In the word, the father of those who
those
dwell.
Those who dwell in tents, so mm-hmm. the father of those who
yes.
dwell.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's right. So it's well, not just a genealogical, the vital idea, you know, of procreation. Be blessed, you know, when he blessed them at creation, and be fruitful and multiply. But also this, I called it an invention of a skill, and discovering something. I think it is. It's used, fathers used in two ways here. Most of the time when we talk about genealogies, we only take about the one in chapter 5. You see that? Forget about this one entirely. And then the history of salvation lies it so that it somewhat loses its independent meaning. Well, let's look a little more at maybe some more things will occur to you as we go on. In 23 and 24, would you mind reading that for us, please? Verses 23 and 24, it's a kind of a nice little song here.
Okay. Lamech said to his wife, Ada and Zillah, hear my voice. You wives of Lamech, hearken to what I say. I have slain a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 77-fold.
All right. Anyone have any questions about that? Comments about it?
Yeah, what does it mean?
All right.
Boasting that he's killed.
Pardon?
Boasting that he's killed
him. Yes, he's killed a young man for wounding him and a young man for striking him. The traditional interpretation has always been that this was a rival in love, and so that this is the first triangle, and things like that. And I suppose it has some sense, although it doesn't really say that. And I don't think that that's the idea. This guy is the first bigamist. I can just hear the preachers getting after that. Now, Cain is the first of a bad lot of murderers, and this Lamech, the ungodly Lamech, is the first of a bad lot of bigamists, you see. And I doubt that very much. There's no doubt about it, though, that it is boasting of someone who has gotten in his way. What do you think he means by this, by saying, if Cain is avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and sevenfold? What's he trying to get at? I think that's really the climax of the song. So he did kill a man, and he's boasting of that. But what's his main point?
Justifiable homicide.
Well, not in the sense of Genesis 9:3, he who sheds man's blood by man shall his blood be shed. I don't think it's that.
No, it sounds that that's what he's really trying to say. If indeed the comment of God in regard to Cain is that Cain's death, or anyone that harms Cain will be avenged sevenfold, that he's carrying it to the extreme here.
Yes, and So it's a contrast to Cain. There's no doubt about that. That's very clear in the text. And if God would avenge Cain, what does this mean then? He will avenge himself. Many people call this, it doesn't mention it here, the sword song. And they assume that because Tubal-Cain has been an artificer in brass and iron, he has invented a sword, you see. So just as the prophet Micah hated those chariots, all the prophets hated all the jets that we have that make so much noise in your PLU in the Corps Air Force Base. they just hated them as military things, and they hated tanks and bombers, you might say. So here, people have said that that Tubal-Cain has also made a sword, and that he's used a sword. That's going a little far. I do think, though, that there's no doubt about this, that he despised that warning that the Lord made. The Lord warned 7 times, whereas he despises it. Take care of himself. To push it a little far, I remember hearing a preacher say it, and it was quite effective. A very traditional type of preacher, but he got it across the congregation saying, this is the first atheist. He says, as far as, if anybody, he was going too far, I think, but he says, as far as anybody saying that God will avenge things, no, that never happens, that's bosh. If anybody messes with me, I will kill him. And 70 times 7 means umpteen times, way to the great extent. Now, if this is material that comes from the Yahwist, that means from the early monarchy, I think it is, they're very much interested in culture and things. They made an epic, a national epic, which more or less helped David's empire people, the successors perhaps of David and Solomon, to more or less live in the world where they were at the peak of the nations in Syria-Palestine. They were also interested in cultural achievements, but they always did that. All the stories we had so far have been kind of crime and punishment. And here you've got just a bit of this crime and punishment idea here, that even though you could look at the cultural gifts from a positive side, and they're good things, they can also be misused, and they can end up in murder. Well, let's go to...
Ralph, before you
leave sure.
it, how, I guess I'm kind of surprised hearing or didn't catch, because I haven't studied this segment, the idea of Lamech will avenge himself 77-fold.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so. You see, playing this off against what God said. Remember last time it said something like this, whosoever smites Cain will be avenged sevenfold. And I said that's the Semitic way of saying God will avenge him sevenfold. And I think that's behind it here too. And therefore I think the contrast, if he says here, if Cain is avenged sevenfold, in other words, if God has promised a sevenfold vengeance, then truly Lamech sevenfold. Now, it's not actually said, but I think that's the contrast over against which this statement is there.
Couldn't it also be read that truly then God would avenge Lamech 70? I mean that God would carry that avenging.
I suppose that's an outside possibility, but I think you're leaving out the whole context here. Do you see that?
No, I don't.
Oh, all right. Well, it seems that what he is doing in the whole first part in 23 is simply boasting of murder.
Okay, let's take it one step then, or in a slightly different direction. I don't want to belabor it, but if indeed we would end up saying that that Cain was not justified in the spilling of blood, and Lamech feels that he is justified in the spilling of blood.
All right, so what? I mean,
then if God will protect Cain, who is unjustified 7 times, is it not equally just, or is it not equally proper then to assume that God would protect Lamech 70 or avenge Lamech 77-fold,
mm-hmm.
who was justified in that?
I see. The difference between your looking at that and the way I would look at it is that you take in that poetry, it's 2 lines, one is equal to the other in verse 24, them as if they are synonymous parallelism. One is saying the very same thing as the other. And whereas I'm simply taking it that it's antithetical. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's the difference. And again, you'd have to take that from... Who can decide that? You can't decide it on the verse itself. It's only from the context, you see that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it would mean if you didn't take it antithetically, you see that. If you take it purely aesthetically, then you're kind of doing it the way they do it after a while in Genesis 9:3, whoso sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. But then that becomes a kind of a societal one. That's even a proverb that was quoted there too. And it's there to protect human life. I don't really see that here. It seems to be much more of a kind of a razia where you've got one of these nomadic persons that will really take vengeance. And I think you have the same thing then, Fani, in the New Testament. How many times must I forgive my brother? 70 times 7, you see that. I think that's kind of the general tradition there. But I'm glad you challenged that. That's good. It's the only way we learn.
Yeah, I think I would agree with the challenge. It seems to me that the context makes Lemach a very boastful and arrogant person, that one would assume that he makes some comparison of his sort between himself and Cain. But furthermore, I mean, if Cain was to be avenged, if he were smitten, because he couldn't obviously avenge himself. Were dead. And the context would seem to suggest that Lamech is saying that if he's smitten, i.e. dead, then...
The imperialism of Christians. The evangelicals, perhaps, example number two. Some of them, not all of them. Is that any better?
Because he couldn't obviously avenge himself. Were dead. And the context would seem to suggest that Lamech is saying that if he's smitten, i.e. dead, then he will be avenged. 70 times 7.
Yeah.
I just don't see any. I know nothing about, you know, the way Hebrew poetry works. So that may be why I can't see the justification for the antithesis here. But simply looking at the context and trying to remember, you know, the conclusion of the story by Cain, it seems to me that. Lamech's boast here is that God will do it. He's a very, very arrogant, boastful person.
Well, I think we could go into that at great length, but I just say offhand that you wouldn't be taking the warning by God to anyone who would see Cain quite as seriously, I think, as the earlier story does. And here it would seem that it's not as if he's appealing to God, but as if as a result of his achievements, and I won't take that from the context.
Yeah, that's right, but I mean somebody who would say that if God is going to avenge Cain 7 times, then certainly in my case it would be 70 times 7, that might just as well be another way of saying, but God doesn't do that sort of thing anyway, it's all in our own hands. And that would be consistent, I think.
Well, that's precisely what I mean, see? Because otherwise, in this case of this young man that he slew for striking him and for wounding him, he doesn't have to worry about that. He's got rid of that guy. He doesn't have to wait for God to do that, see?
I see. Well, I think that in the end, we see Lamech is the same sort of character. It just seems to me that you get that by having him say in a very sort of... impious, challenging, boastful way, all right, if God were to do this, then in my case, you'd do so much more.
Yeah.
Meaning, of course, that God never is going to do that as far as Cain is concerned.
Well, in that part, I would agree with you, definitely, yeah. Mm-hmm. So maybe perhaps agree a little more than it just appears on the surface. Yeah. Well, listen.
What are you going to do with the balance that the whole Cain story is the relationship between God and Cain, God and Cain speaking. But in the Lamech story, it's Lamech speaking to his wife. God doesn't appear on the scene in the Lamech thing. Or is that just simply a poetic device to say the same thing?
Well, I wouldn't assume that he must appear on the scene. It's enough that God, that he, in his song in verse 24a, refers to God's warning. See, when he says, if Cain is avenged sevenfold, you could more or less add, I think that's part of the whole tradition, as God said, you know, when he put the mark on him. And they've just had this story, you see. It's just been in the context, so I would fit that right there in the context. As it stands, verse 23 and 24 is kind of an appendix. It's rather loosely added to the genealogy. And so I wouldn't make too much of it. Perhaps was an individual, a special tradition by itself, and pretty well known. Well, listen, let's go on to a few other things here.
Can I just ask one quick question?
Sure.
On this? is then the potential danger from the cultural achievements of man that he is going to separate himself from God and no longer think of his dependence on God, sort of think of himself as master of all?
Yes, well, let's take a modern example. I think you're asking a good question here, and it's apropos. When Yuri Gagarin went up, and even before that, when they set up Sputnik, they said, if I remember correctly, a lot of propaganda in the paper, but this was a moon or a star that wasn't created by the God they will test. Do you remember that? It was quite evident. It would seem as if there's a good example. Now, in a sense, that was a true statement. It was not created in the magical way that maybe many Russian Orthodox people thought that things should be created. You see that? Just like Yuri Gagarin was the one who said he didn't see God up there, and things like that. So there was a certain truth to that. This was created by man, made in the USSR. Nixon said the same thing for us when he said it was the greatest week in the history of the world when we put a man on the moon. Remember when they came back? And he boasted too, you see that. I think there you have it. It's something like the Tower of Babel story. I think in many, all these stories is sort of exceeding the limit. Now this one is just a snippet of two verses here, you see that. But at the same time, when you say that, especially in the context there of God of the Old Testament, you'd say, well, we did it, just what you're saying. And in contrast to it. Now, whether the missiles and other things are used, how do you look at missiles? What if you're a military man? Do you think that in a world, I'm not a pacifist, in a world of injustice, you do need bombers. You do need bombs. Remember, PLU graduates said, yes, I went up to Whidbey Island and they sat me in one of those Navy planes, but he said, it was nice, he said. I asked him, what are you going to do? He said, but I know what that thing is for. That he comes from a Mennonite background. He's not about to do that. You see that? I don't think that I necessarily would be against that. But it depends upon how you're going to use that, for misuse or not. It's the whole Vietnam business, you see that. And so I think that God's cultural gifts are there, and we can use them or we cannot use them.
But as the father of the inventors of the arts and the sort of industrial arts, and the fine arts and the industrial arts, then they might be very arrogant about his creative position.
Or at least,
to the fifth bar and says, now I can not only create and give civilization the shape that it has, but I can take away at my...
The very point. Mm-hmm.
And then
sort
of boastful about this, and then sort of asserts that he is, in a way, immune from the wrath of God.
Mm-hmm. Precisely. That would be the way in which I would look at it. I would say that's the majority view of almost all scholars. Even the old tradition really kept that tradition quite good there. But we've got to get to the next part yet for our discussion here of the genealogy of Seth and the very end of it. And Herb, would you mind reading 25 and 26 there? There's another little appendix. Maybe once upon a time it was an entire genealogy that went through seven. See, the genealogies usually don't have just three. This is very much apocryphated. But it is apocryphated here for one reason. That's because it comes to a climax and he's got to say something at the end.
And Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and called his name Seth, for she said, God has appointed for me another child instead of Abel, for Cain slew him. To Seth also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. At that time, men began to call upon the name of the Lord.
Okay. Well, the first part that we've known very well, Adam knew his wife, and then you've got this name, Seth, and there's a kind of a jubilation, just the way when Cain was there was jubilation. This is the creature that I've got with the help of the Lord. Now you've got the same sort of thing. God has appointed me another child, and Seth means substitute. He's been put there instead of Abel, for Cain slew him. And then to Seth, there's nothing mentioned except that word Enosh, and the only thing you can get in Hebrew, it's another name for Ish, but it's a kind of man in his weakness. In other words, it's a word for man, for human. It's another synonym of the word for human, man. And then at that point comes this statement about the beginning of religion. Now this is rather surprising. And in primeval times then. Now, when it says call on the name of the Lord, that's of course praying, but sacrifice never stands by itself. Rituals, liturgy, all what becomes a highly developed system doesn't stand by itself. But what is it basic to all of it is this, we'd say praying. And therefore, just as many of the other things that we've discussed here in Genesis 1 and 2 belong to be human, to be human is to be religious. When you were talking last night about Red China, it was fascinating to me, absolutely fascinating. I was just kind of computerizing everything that you were saying into religion. And when you had Mao's picture up there, and the end of the operas where it almost was some sort of climax, otherworldly climax, I guess then it would seem to me that that's just part of human culture. Tillich says that you've got all these world religions, and some of them are genuine religions, some of them are pseudo-religions, and newer ones. And I think that's it. People have talked about the American religion and the ritual on Sunday now of the football games, and that this is very, very much what finally is the American religion. And it's very, very deep. So it would seem to be human is to be religious in some way. And though here, of course, the Yahwist use the name for Yahweh, calling on God. And Herb quoted that today, Acts 17, when you're calling on any deity, you're really calling upon the God that the Yahwist knows as the true God.
Is there any textual basis here for the idea that this little amendment at that time, men began to call upon the name of the Lord, that they are speaking or calling or praying to a different God than the Creator God? Because, you know, you have all of these Gnostic sects that identify themselves with Seth, and Seth is a kind of messenger of the true God.
Oh yes, and then later on Enoch, they take the one from Enoch too.
And then, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so correct. I was just wondering, in this sentence here, is there any...
No, I don't think so. That is a much later development, I think, at least the form of it in Gnosticism. The form that you might have had in earlier Israel would have been, well, any other... there were all kinds of gods round about, you see, and all kinds of deities. Basically, I suppose, whatever is your ultimate concern, whatever you fear, whatever you trust, whatever you love most, that's really your the center of all of it.
But it's perfectly clear here in this text that you're talking about Yahweh, the same Lord that we've been dealing with already.
Well, of course, in the normative document like what was being prepared here, this is scripture, and these are normative documents for the faith of Israel. You couldn't possibly, though they know these other gods exist, the first commandment says it, that there are other gods that exist, for you, normatively, there shouldn't be any. And therefore, it's not as if he would immediately put it in your world religions perspective that you're talking about, you see that? Mm-hmm. Or the one that you used this morning in your perspective, Acts 17, that him whom you worship in ignorance, I will declare unto you. You are worshiping the true God, but I will declare that unto you. A little boy came to me, a seminary student, he wasn't so little, although they're younger in New Guinea than elsewhere, Martin the Seminary. His name was Kamu Khan. And he said to me, we had just had the story of the driving out of the demons in Mark 5, that real wild story, you know, about the man who had legions in him. And I thought I had explained it, you know, all, no answers possible, no questions possible after the professor explained it. And then he came up to me after this, and he said, you really have to tell me, because I'm not clear about this. My father is an evangelist in the Lutheran mission that I knew up in the Highlands, and the German missionaries had told him, over against the spirit worship and all other gods, they don't exist, the spirits don't exist, there's only God exists. And that's the only one. And these spirits aren't supposed to be, see that? And here Jesus is casting out the spirits. Who's right? My father, who says they don't exist? Or all the rest of the people who say they do and fear them, and people die on that in New Guinea. They're realities, real realities. They should be nothingnesses, you see that? But they aren't. They have real existence. And so, I guess the only thing I could give to him, and biblicist that I am, I also have a passage for it, is 1 Corinthians 8:3, where the apostle is speaking about meats offered to idols, and where many of the Corinthians says, well, yeah, we can eat all that stuff because an idol isn't anything anyway. And it's 8:4. Hence, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that an idol has no real existence. He's kind of quoting the Corinthian enthusiasts who could eat anything they wanted, any time, any place. And that there is no God but one. For although there may be so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords. I think the King James has so-called gods and so-called lords. In other words, there are a lot of religions. There are a lot of gods, a lot of lords. Yet for us, there is one God. I think monotheism, even the monotheism of Moses, is not a theoretical monotheism like the Muezzin has from the minaret, when he says there is no God but the God, but Allah, and Muhammad is the prophet. The first commandment is a practical. For us, there can't be any gods. And that's what he says here. Yet for us, there's one God, the Father, from whom are all things, for whom we exist. And one Lord, Jesus Christ, you see that? And it's that sort of thing. Am I getting at your concern there?
Yeah. I have a little problem with what you just said there, though.
All right.
I think it, what Paul says is there are no gods but God. But Paul is very clear on the existence of demons, of the existence of evil spirits, not as gods. And I think...
Well, I think they do exist, but they shouldn't.
Okay.
For us. We shouldn't love them in that sense of existence.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But when this young... We've had parallel problems like this. When this young man would come and say, my grandfather and my mother and all the other people really work and live among these, and he probably would have had to say, my father does too, but that isn't the way he was taught. The response to that might be, of course these demons really exist, but we have the conviction that Christ is stronger than they.
I wouldn't argue with that.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I was really saying the same thing. I don't remember precisely what I said. I know I went to that passage. But basically I would say, yeah, they may well exist for us, but they shouldn't exist. So even in the Old Testament, the prophets can sometimes call gods the Elohim, which means the nothingnesses. And the prophet Ezekiel has very bad language, and almost scatological. He calls them shit gods. And you try to listen to them, and that's why throughout, especially Isaiah, there is I am He. There is none beside me. And a very strong sort of thing. But I wouldn't deny that they exist. I guess they exist for me too, if you want to just ask my personal view of that. So I think that when young men would tell me, and it hasn't happened so much at PLU, but at, in Chicago where I lived, of where they got into all kinds of stuff, young Roman Catholics who shouldn't have gotten into it, as baptized Christians, Satanism and whatnot. I think that there was a reality for them. But it was not the reality of their baptism. They had to be told that, you know. They just, so I'm really saying the same thing that you are saying.
But the other thing, the question I wanted to raise was that in this calling on the name of the Lord, there are two parallel passages which use exactly the same words. And that's Abraham in 8:12. I cribbed this out of here. Abraham in 8:12. After
8:12?
12:8.
Yeah, of course.
In 12:8, after the call, then he removed to Bethel and he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. And then later, after the Beersheba incident with Isaac, I think I'm right here. It's 26:20. My glasses aren't quite that good. 26:25, yes.
Well, it's a common.
So he built an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord. Mm-hmm. But those are the two parallel passages that are given here. Is that significant? I would suppose that the Hebrew words would be almost exactly the same.
Oh yeah, but it's not a matter of the words. I think that Abram went to the same place there in at Mamre, that all the other people worshipped. Bethel was, archaeologists can prove that, was a place of worship long before Abram came along there, you see. That's what you're referring to.
Mm-hmm.
And Abram had no question. I prayed in the mosque too, right where we were digging archaeologically. And the young men said, because I prayed with a big cross, you shouldn't do that in a mosque. The young guys who were looking in, the sheikh didn't know it because he was facing Mecca. But I was invited to go to a mosque in the village where we were working. And I went. I thought, now I'm going to pray. And I did. And I prayed as I usually did. The young boys who had been excluded from the mosque, who were our water carriers and everything else, they were looking in the windows. Had been an old church once upon a time, and they said to me later that you can't do that, you see. But there was a very obvious case where, in a sense, I was right in a mosque, you see that. I think my understanding, in that sense, the Corinthian enthusiasts are right, that there is only one God, but my understanding of that one God, only 20 miles from Nazareth where I was doing this, was certainly a Christian. I remember praying the Lord's Prayer. I remember how universal the Lord's Prayer is. It is not specifically Christian, or Judeo-Christian either. It's very wide. And I think that Abram came to these places and called on them at the same time. But the context, Herb, here, I think, in Genesis 1-11, is one of universal before the covenants and before the announcements. And therefore, I think what we'd have to do this. It's a Yahwistic account. He couldn't use, he might have used the name Elohim, but he usually didn't, you see that. So you can't ask him to do that. It's just like for us, we use the word God. And for monotheists, you can use that word God. If somehow that's challenged, then you might have to use the word Lord, you see that. And we do that too. So I don't think that would make that much difference. Let me try something else on you. See, I suppose our time is almost up. Some of you know I've been working on this for some time, and I wrote this, I think this is apropos to what you're saying here, that it would seem that already before the Israelites came along, the divine blessing of God or gods extended not just only to the blessing of a family. That would be Genesis chapter 5, the family begat so and so, be fruitful and multiply. But also to human civilization, when in that case, most of the time, the gods supply men with all these things, cultural growth and so forth. But now what this Israelite account does is more or less says that men are the ones who investigate these things and discover and invent. And it's the blessing of the Creator which does this. I think that's very clear. So that's why I suppose civilization and art and these things did not have any sacred character in Israel. Now I suppose we might, as people who live, and here's our problem, Herb, we live within a covenant, a new covenant, or if we're Jews, the old covenant, in a history of salvation. Genesis 1-11 is before that history of salvation, you see that? And because we live in this covenant, we more or less push that to the farthest. Christians tend, as you all know, if there's a Jew next door or a pagan, not to leave those persons alone until we've either put them in the ghetto or converted them. And Jews have done the same thing. Not as bad as we, I don't think. But the idea is that when we don't evaluate the cultural achievements of other people as a gift of God, God has as much a history with the Chinese in Peking today as he has a history with those in the church here and with the Jews. Are you not like the Ethiopians unto me, Amos says? I brought the Philistines from Kir and from Kaftor, and I brought the Syrians from Kir, and just the way I brought you out of Egypt. And now, naturally, the Old Testament is emphasizing mostly from chapter 12 on the history of salvation, the New Testament, the history of God's new people. But that's what I mentioned here when we were talking about the image of God, that that's a history with everybody. And that's not abrogated even when you become a murderer or when you blow it. You still remain the creature. And I think that when you exploit the structures of civilization, I use the jet idea with the church politician, for the sake of the so-called kingdom of God, you don't realize what you're doing. I think then if there's a storm, it isn't only that Christian who has signed himself with a cross when the jet goes off, or that prays. Everybody prays. It's human to pray. And it isn't just in foxholes that the way the pious people sometimes say, well, everybody, they just turn and be converted and get to religion when they're in the foxhole. That's a human thing to do, to call. And if Langdon Gilkey in his book on Naming the Whirlwind, that God who speaks on the whirlwind, the renewal of religious language in the world is correct. He says that even though modern secular man shies away from God talk, theological talk, we aren't as pious as we used to be, that we speak in ultimates and not just only in penultimates, and that our language kind of betrays this. So on the one hand, I think, as if you want to sum up what we've had here, the achievements of mankind are human. That's what they are. On the other hand, and here we may have to look at this a little more, but I'll leave that to your consideration, it seems that there's also potential for real danger in them. And the surprising thing, however, to me, is that religion is here considered a valid expression of human culture. What does that mean about what you talked about last night? The Mao cult, do you see that? What does that mean about other expressions of humankind? I think that, let me just read something that I've written here. I don't know if this is, the fateful separation of man's cultural achievements from God's activity has often been agreed on by both religious people and by atheists. In other words, the religious people are only intent on getting somebody to join the church or some sort of salvation, And they say that's the extent of God's activity. All activity of God is really activity in the church, or Judaism, with what he's doing with Israel. This is the experiment in of being atheistic working, or in religious terms is our religious imperialism that comes from within the committed covenant people, either the Jews, Menachem Begin, example number one, or the imperialism of Christians, the evangelicals, perhaps example number two, some of them, not all of them. Is that any better? And I think that the universal aspect of what we have in this chapter really has something that we really have to look at. Now, any more comments after the sermon? I really haven't preached a sermon on it, and I often find, I have to say that if I have preached a sermon in a congregation on these texts, that I do much better with them.
Well, you talked about man's culture of achievements.
Yes.
Going on. Would you think there's a possibility to say, man, they went to the moon in 1968 or 1969 or something along there, and that Texas had the greatest achievements in the history of mankind. And he should have said, say, one.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But had mankind over these millennia not been in rebellion, could we have done that, 2,000 years ago? Made that cultural achievement then?
The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Maybe that means that a right relationship to God might, enable you to be wiser and not short-circuited as often as it happens. I really don't know. As far as I know, the science is international, and it may make as many discoveries in the communist bloc, nuclear fission, and all the rest of these things. That's our version of artificer and brass and iron, as we make. I don't know. I could imagine that people who restrict God's activity only to his activity within the church, say Christians and so forth, and in mission work, might themselves be as limited because of those blinders to God's activity elsewhere as an atheist would be limited. So I think we are always creating idols, and we're always doing that. Whether we're in the church, we're just as human in the church. Just because we have a commitment doesn't mean that we are no longer human, see? And let me say it this way. This being religious here has nothing to do with a commitment. People, to be human is to be religious. It doesn't have anything to do with, I don't think with a set form of religion, or anything. I think that if you come to a Hindu temple, Herb, correct me if I'm wrong on that, you ring a bell. And I asked them, why do you ring the bell? And they said, because so then the God knows I'm here. And that's calling on the name of the Lord, just in that sense. It can be verbal, it can be lamenting, it can be praising, it can be all the various expressions of religion all the way through. Am I somewhat answering your question? I don't know whether we would have, as committed Christians, would be able to be better cultural achievers.
Well, in this passage, though, there's no indication whatsoever that the cultural achievements are the consequence of wisdom.
That's right, yeah.
And understanding wisdom in that sense of obedience or fear of the Lord.
Yeah, as this man asked me the question, the only thing
is... If the cultural achievements were a consequence of that sort of wisdom, then probably the potential danger that we're talking about here wouldn't come up.
It might be, yes. Although I have seen look, the greatest tragedy that's happened in the 20th century has happened in the nation of baptized Christians and Lutherans, I mean, Lutherans and Catholics in Germany. We can't forgive that. You forget that, you know what I mean? I don't think that makes us immune. Then how unhuman can you get? It seems that when Christians seem to be, well, as if this is part of their prerogative, they become very unhuman. Maybe I'm just a little too uptight about that, I don't know.
Well, just because you have an individual Christian who has been baptized, or a nation of baptized Christians, doesn't mean that they can't spend a good deal of it. I can't spend a good deal of my life in rebellion, or that nation in rebellion against
it. Yeah, well, that's really what I'm saying, correct. Mm-hmm. And their Christianity will not make them better scientists. That's what, I guess, what your concern was. And I don't know.
Well, God said, you know, I mean, as the layman would read it, He gave us the earth or the world or whatever it entails, which might mean even the universe, to be masters of. If the moon is part of this, then possibly we could have achieved it earlier had we not. Always been in rebellion.
Mm-hmm. And still you have the Tower of Babel, and sure. A big achievement like that can also be misused, you see that.
Hmm.
Oh, Tim.
Well, that's all the Hebrews, or the Jewish tradition, related cultural achievements to religion.
Pardon?
How did the Hebrews relate cultural achievements to religion?
Well, they have a genealogy here, you know, but it's not just a genealogy of men, but in each case, next to a man, there's a kind of a note appended to it of what either he achieved or was achieved at his time. And then of all things, it includes among those achievements, religion.
Religion has a cultural achievement,
yeah.
But these other cultural achievements, what form do they take in forming religion, are in regards to the cultural achievement of religion?
Many times they were, this is a good question, they were merely subjected, all cultural achievements were subjected to religion, let's say for instance among the Sumerians, among the Babylonians. Savonarola wanted everybody in culture when he took over in his Reformation in Florence, to simply dance as if they were already in heaven, you see? And all of these things were entirely sacredized, you see that? Whereas I think there has to be a role for some of this being really secular. Is that answering your question?
Yeah, so the cultural achievements, I mean, are apart from relating to religion necessarily, even though they can be understood as a gift of God.
Yes, precisely. In other words, God's gift aren't only to the people who have known Him as we have come to know Him as Jews or Christians.
Yeah. But the gift exists.
Yes, precisely. And I think religion is a gift then too. You can't always say it's a part of the devil's work, you see.
Yeah.
And at least that's the way I would understand this section here.
You made the point that we have to distinguish between religion and commitment. Religion and commitment to God. I thought that it was made very well by Bishop Newbegin, who was with the International Missionary Council before the World Council of Churches. One time he was speaking to a group of Hindus, and they asked him to describe what the Christian faith was about. And after he was finished, one man came up to him and he said, "Sir, I agree with you completely, but I still remain a Hindu." He was a member of a group of the followers of the god Vishnu, who argued on whether God saved people like a mother monkey or a mother cat. The mother monkey saves its children by letting them grab on the fur, and she goes up the tree, and that is synergism. You have to grab on, but God will save you. And then there's the mother cat who grabs the kittens by the nape of the neck and goes up the tree, and of course that's whether they like it or not. And this was a man with the cat theology. And
Newbegin, thinking, well, I would have been stumped by this one, but Newbegin said to this man, let me ask you a question. What would you do if you found that your theory of religion was not correct? And the man thought for a moment. He said, well, then I would look for another. And he said, that's where I couldn't go along with you. Because if my, quote, theory of the Christian faith is not correct, then I am lost. There is no way for me to go. And that, I thought, sort of divides the commitment from calling on some name or other. That's where I like to see this Yahweh, if that's what we're really seeing coming through. Calling on the name of Yahweh. If you're crossing yourself in the mosque, you're putting all yourself in that, aren't you?
Yeah, oh yeah, I didn't, the fact that I'm open to world religions,
that's
it,
right.
Does not mean that I have left my Christian commitment. But I would have to say this, that I also, as a Christian, with my commitment, must be open to a challenge from all world religions.
Right.
And that's what he is saying there.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And if God is the all-encompassing reality that encompasses all reality, then it would seem that world religions is the place today, at least, where a lot of this comes together. And it would seem to me that Genesis 1 to 11 be the place where we could begin to talk with people from various parts of world religion.
Mm-hmm.
What has happened in Genesis 1 and 11 is that we have Judaized it or Christianized it. And I think that's where our problem is. And this is just merely one attempt, and I'm not the only one. Some of the best work here, well, there's a bit of it already started by Gonko already. He was open to some of these things. But, though Casuto, Umberto Casuto, Jewish scholar, has opened up things, he remains a pretty much fundamentalistic type of Jew. The group that's with Professor Westerman at Heidelberg today, and Ernst Kriesemann, are people who have done new work here, and I think rather good work in raising up questions, but it's a whole...